Whore, Bianca? A murderer 10 times over, sir, but not a whore. Nothing so simple as a whore.
He studied Marius, as though he thought this heated, passionately florid man was beautiful indeed. And, well, he was.
Ah, but you taught her the art of murder, said Marius almost tenderly, his fingers massaging the man's shoulder, while with his left arm he reached around Martino's back until his left hand might lock on the man's shoulder with his right.
He bent his forehead to touch Martino's temple. Martino shook himself all over.
I've drunk too much. I never taught her any such thing.
Ah, but you did. You taught her, and to kill for such paltry sums. Master, what is it to us?
My son forgets himself, said Marius, still looking at Martino. He forgets that I am bound to kill you on behalf of our sweet lady, whom you so finagled into your dark, sticky plots.
She rendered me a service, said Martino. Let me have the boy.
Beg pardon?
You mean to kill me, so do it. But let me have the boy. A kiss, sir, that's all I ask. A kiss, that is the world. I'm too drunk for anything else.
Please, master, I can't endure this, I said.
Then how will you endure eternity, my child? Don't you know that's what I mean to give you? What power under God is there that can break me?
He threw a fierce, angry glance at me, but it seemed more artifice than true emotion.
I've learnt my lessons, I said. I only hate to see him die.
Ah, yes, then you have learnt. Martino, kiss my child, if he'll allow it, and mark you, be gentle when you do.
It was I who leaned across the table now and planted my kiss on the man's cheek. He turned and caught my mouth with his, hungry, sour with wine, but energetically, electrically hot. The tears sprang to my eyes. I opened my mouth to him and let his tongue come into me, and with my eyes shut, I felt it quiver and his lips become tight, as if they had been turned to hard metal, clamped to me and unable to close. My master had him, had his throat, and the kiss was frozen, and I, weeping, put out my hand blindly to find the very place in his neck where my master's evil teeth had driven in. I felt my master's silky lips. I felt the hard teeth beneath them. I felt the tender neck. I opened my eyes and pulled myself away. My doomed Martino sighed and moaned and closed his lips, and sat back in my master's grip with his eyes half-masked. He turned his head slowly towards my master. In a small, raw, drunken voice, he spoke.
For Bianca.
For Bianca, I said.
I sobbed, muffling it with my hand. My master drew up. With his left hand he smoothed back Martino's damp and tangled hair.
For Bianca, he said into his ear.
Never, never should have let her live,
came the last sighing words from Martino. His head fell forward over my master's right arm. My master kissed the back of his head and let him slip down onto the table.
Charming to the last, said he, just a real poet to the bottom of your soul.
I stood up, pushing the bench away behind me, and I moved out into the center of the room. I cried and cried, and couldn't muffle it with my hand. I dug into my jacket for a handkerchief, and just as I went to wipe my tears, I stumbled backwards over the dead, humpbacked man, and almost fell. I cried out, a terrible, weak, and ignominious cry. I moved back away from him, and away from the bodies of his companions, until I felt behind me the heavy, scratchy tapestry, and smelled its dust and threads.
Ah! So this was what you wanted of me? I sobbed. I veritably sobbed. That I should hate it? That I should weep for them, fight for them, beg for them?
He sat at the table still, Christ of the Last Supper, with his neatly parted hair, his shining face, his ruddy hands folded one on top of the other, looking with his hot and swimming eyes at me.
Weep for one of them, at least one, he said. His voice grew wrathful. Is that too much to ask, that one death be regretted among so many?
He rose from the table. He seemed to quake with his rage. I pushed the handkerchief over my face, sobbing into it.
For a nameless beggar in a makeshift boat for a bed, we have no tears, do we? And would not our pretty Bianca suffer because we've played the young Adonis in her bed? And of some of those, we weep for none but that one, the very most evil without question, because he flatters us, is it not so?
I knew him, I whispered. I mean, in this short time I knew him, and...
And you would have them run from you, anonymous as foxes in the brush.
He pointed to the tapestries blazoned with the courtly hunt.
Behold with a man's eyes what I show you.
There was a sudden darkening of the room, a flutter of all the many candles. I gasped, but it was only he, come to stand right in front of me and look down at me, a feverish, blushing being whose very heat I could feel, as if every pore of him gave forth warm breath.
Master, I cried, swallowing my sobs, are you happy with what you've taught me or not? Are you happy with what I've learnt or not? Don't you play with me over this. I'm not your puppet, sir. No, never that. What would you have me be, then? Why this anger?
I shuddered all over, the tears veritably flooding from my eyes.
I would be strong for you, but I knew him.
Why, because he kissed you?
He leant down and picked up my hair in his left hand. He yanked me towards him.
Marius, for the love of God!
He kissed me. He kissed me as Martino had, and his mouth was as human and as hot. He slipped his tongue into mine, and I felt not blood, but manly passion. His finger burnt against my cheek. I broke away. He let me break away.
Oh, come back to me, my cold white one, my God,
I whispered. I lay my face on his chest. I could hear his heart. I could hear it beating. I had never before heard it, never heard a pulse within the stone chapel of his body.
Come back to me, most dispassionate teacher. I don't know what you want.
Oh, my darling, he sighed. Oh, my love.
And there came the old demon shower of his kisses, not the mock of a passionate man, but his affection, petals soft, so many tributes laid upon my face and hair.
Oh, my beautiful Amadeo. Oh, my child, he said.
Love me, love me, love me, I whispered. Love me and take me into it with you. I am yours.
In stillness he held me. I drowsed on his shoulders. A little breeze came, but it did not move the heavy tapestries in which the French lords and ladies drifted in their eternal and leafy green forest, among hounds that would forever bay, and birds that would always sing. Finally he released me, and he stepped back. He walked away from me, his shoulders hunched, his head down. Then, with a lazy gesture, he beckoned for me to come, and yet he moved out of the room too fast. I ran after him, down the stone stairs to the street. The doors were open when I got there. The cold wind washed away my tears. It washed away the evil heat of the room. I ran and ran along the stone quays, over the bridges, and after him towards the square. I didn't catch him until I reached the molo, and there he was walking, a tall man in a red hood and cape, past San Marco and towards the harbor. I ran after him. The wind from the sea was icy and very strong. It blasted me, and I felt doubly cleansed.
"Don't leave me, master," I called out.
My words were swallowed up, but he heard. He came to a stop, as if it really were my doing. He turned and waited for me to catch up with him, and then he picked up my outstretched hand.
"Master, hear my lesson," I said. "Judge my work."
I caught my breath in haste and went on.
"I saw you drink from those who were evil, convicted in your heart of some gross crime. I saw you feast, as it is your nature. I saw you take the blood with which you must live. And all about you lies this evil world, this wilderness of men no better than beasts, who will yield up a blood as sweet and rich for you as innocent blood. I see it. That's what you meant for me to see, and it's done."
His face was impassive. He merely studied me. It seemed the burning fever in him was already dying away. The distant torches along the arcades shone on his face, and it was whitening and as ever hard. The ships creaked in the harbor. There came distant murmurs and cries from those, perhaps, who cannot or never sleep. I glanced up at the sky, fearful I would see the fatal light. He'd be gone.
"If I drink such as that, master, the blood of the wicked and those whom I overpower. Will I become like you?"
He shook his head. "Many a man has drunk another's blood, Amadeo," he said in a low but calm voice. His reason had come back to him, his manners, his seeming soul. "Would you be with me and be my pupil and my love?"
"Yes, master, always and forever, or for so long as nature gives to you and me."
"Oh, it isn't fanciful, the words I spoke. We are immortal, and only one enemy can destroy us. It's the fire that burns in that torch there, or in the rising sun. Sweet to think on it, that when we are at last weary of all this world, there is the rising sun."
"I am yours, master."
I hugged him close and tried to vanquish him with kisses. He endured them, and even smiled, but he didn't move. But when I broke off and made a fist of my right hand as if to hit him, which I could never have done, to my amazement he began to yield. He turned and took me in his powerful and ever-careful embrace.
"Amadeo, I can't go on without you," he said. His voice was desperate and small. "I meant to show you evil, not sport. I meant to show you the wicked price of my immortality, and that I did. But in so doing, I saw it myself, and my eyes are dazzled, and I am hurt and tired."
He laid his head against my head, and he held tight to me.
"Do what you will to me, sir," I said. "Make me suffer and long for it, if that's what you want. I am your fool. I am yours."
He released me and kissed me formally. "Four nights, my child," he said. He moved away. He kissed his fingers and planted that last kiss on my lips, and then he was gone. "I go now to an ancient duty. 4 nights. Till then." I stood alone in the earliest chill of the morning. I stood alone beneath a paling sky. I knew better than to look for him. In the greatest dejection, I walked back through the alleys, cutting across little bridges to wander into the depth of the waking city. For what, I didn't know. I was half surprised when I realized I had returned to the house of the murdered men. I was surprised when I saw their doorway still open, as if a servant would at any moment appear. No one appeared. Slowly the sky above ripened to a pale white, and then to a faint blue. Mist crawled along the top of the canal. I went over the small bridge to the doorway, and again went up the stairs. A powdery light came in from the loosely slatted windows. I found the banquet room, where the candles still burnt. The smell of tobacco and wax and of pungent food was close and hanging in the air. I walked inside, and I inspected the dead men, who lay as we had left them, disheveled and now slightly yellowed and waxen, and a prey to the gnats and the flies. There was no sound but the humming of the flies. The spilt wine had dried on the table in pools. The corpses were clean of all the rampant marks of death. I was sick again, sick to trembling, and I took a deep breath that I shouldn't retch. Then I realized why I had come. Men in those days wore short cloaks on their jackets, sometimes affixed, as you probably know. I needed one of these, and took it, ripping it loose from the humpback man, who lay almost on his face. It was a flaring coat of canary yellow, with white fox for its border, and a lining of heavy silk. I tied knots in it, and made a thick, deep sack of it, and then I went up and down the table, gathering up the goblets, dashing out the contents first, and then putting them in my sack. Soon my sack was red with drops of wine and grease from where I'd rested it on the board. I stood when finished, making certain that no goblet had escaped. I had them all. I studied the dead men, my sleeping, red-haired Martino, his face on the bare marble in a puddle of the slopped wine, and Francisco, from whose head did leak a small bit of darkened blood. The flies buzzed and droned over this blood, as they did over the grease pooled around the remnants of the roasted pig. A battalion of little black beetles had come, most common in Venice, for they are carried by the water, and it made its way over the table toward Martino's face. A quiet, warming light came in through the open doorway. The morning had come. With one sweeping glance that imprinted on my mind the details of this scene for all time, I went out and home. The boys were awake and busy when I arrived. An old carpenter was already there, fixing the door which I had shattered with the axe. I gave to the maid my bulky sack of clanking cups, and she, sleepy and having just arrived, took it without a remark. I felt a tightening inside me, a sickening, a sudden feeling that I would burst. My body seemed too small, too imperfect an enclosure for all I knew and felt. My head throbbed. I wanted to lie down, but before that I had to see Ricardo. I had to find him and the older boys. I had to. I went walking through the house until I came to them, all gathered for a lesson with the young lawyer who came from Padua only once or twice a month to begin our instructions in the law. Ricardo saw me in the door and motioned for me to be quiet. The teacher was speaking. I had nothing to say. I only leant against the door and looked at my friends. I loved them. Yes, I did love them. I would die for them. I knew it. And with a terrible relief, I began to cry. Ricardo saw me turn away, and, slipping out, he came to me.
"What is it, Amadeo?"
he asked. I was too delirious with my own torment. I saw again the slaughtered dinner party. I turned to Ricardo and wound him in my arms, so comforted by his warmth and his human softness compared to the master. And then I told him that I would die for him, die for any of them, die for the master, too.
"But why? What is this? Why vow this to me now?"
he asked. I couldn't tell him about the slaughter. I couldn't tell him of the coldness in me that had watched the men die. I went off into my master's bedchamber, and I lay down and tried to sleep. In late afternoon, when I woke to find the doors had been closed, I climbed out of the bed and went to the master's desk. To my astonishment, I saw his book was there, the book that was always hidden when out of his sight. Of course, I could not turn a page of it, but it was open, and there lay a page covered in writing, in Latin, and though it seemed a strange Latin and hard for me, there was no mistaking the final words. "How can so much beauty hide such a bruised and steely heart? And why must I love him? Why must I lean in my weariness upon his irresistible yet indomitable strength? Is he not the wizened funereal spirit of a dead man in a child's clothes?" I felt a strange prickling over my scalp and over my arms. Is this what I was, a bruised and steely heart, the wizened funereal spirit of a dead man in a child's clothes? Oh, but I couldn't deny it. I couldn't say it wasn't true. And yet how hurtful, how positively cruel it seemed. No, not cruel, merely merciless and accurate. And what right had I to expect anything else? I started to cry. I lay down in our bed, as was my custom, and plumped the softest pillows to make a nest for my crooked left arm and my head. 4 nights. How should I endure it? What did he want of me? That I go forth to all the things I knew and loved, and take my leave of them as a mortal boy? That is what he would instruct, and that I should do. Only a few hours were allowed to me by fate. I was awakened by Ricardo, who shoved a sealed note in my face.
"Who sent this?"
I asked sleepily. I sat up and I pushed my thumb beneath the folded paper and broke the wax seal.
"Read it and you tell me. 4 men came to deliver it, a company of 4. Must be some damned important thing."
"Yes," I said, unfolding it, "and to make you look so fearful, too." He stood there with his arms folded. I read. "Dearest darling one, stay indoors. Do not on any account leave the house, and bar any who seek to enter. Your wicked English lord, the Earl of Harlech, has discovered your identity through the most unscrupulous nosing about, and in his madness vows to take you back with him to England, or leave you in fragments at your master's door. Confess all to your master, only his strength can save you, and do send me something in writing, lest I too lose my wits over you, and over the tales of horror which are cried out this morning in every canal and piazza for every ear. Your devoted Bianca."
"Well, damn it," I said, folding up the letter. 4 nights Marius will be gone, and now this. Am I to hide for these crucial 4 nights under this roof?"
"You had better," said Ricardo.
"Then you know the story?"
"Bianca told me. The Englishman, having traced you there and heard tell of you being there all the time, would have torn her lodgings to pieces if her guests had not stopped him en masse.
"And why didn't they kill him, for the love of God?" I said disgustedly. He looked most worried and sympathetic.
"I think they count on our master to do it," he said, "as it is you that the man wants. How can you be certain the master means to stay away for 4 nights? When has he ever said such things? He comes, he goes, he warns no one."
Don't argue with me," I answered patiently. "Ricardo, he isn't coming home for 4 nights, and I will not stay cooped up in this house, and not while Lord Harleck stirs up dirt."
"You'd better stay here," Ricardo answered. "Amadeo, this Englishman is famous with his sword. He practices with a fencing master. He's the terror of the taverns. You knew that when you picked up with him, Amadeo. Think on what you do. He's famous for everything bad and nothing good."
"So then come with me. You need only distract him and I'll take him."
"No, you're good with your sword, true enough, but you can't take a man who's been practicing with the blade since before you were born."
I lay back down on the pillow. What should I do? I was on fire to go out into the world, on fire to gaze at things with my great sense of the drama and significance of my last days among the living. And now this. And the man who had been worth a few nights' riotous rough-house pleasure was no doubt advertising far and wide his discontent. It was bitter, but it seemed I had to stay at home. There was nothing to do. I wanted very much to kill this man, kill him with my own dagger and sword, and even thought I had a good chance of it. But what was this petty adventure to what lay before me when my master returned? The fact was, I had already left the world of regular things, the world of regular scores to be settled, and could not be drawn now into a foolish blunder that might be my forfeit of the strange destiny towards which I moved.
"All right, and Bianca is safe from this man?"
I asked Ricardo.
"Quite safe. She has more admirers and can fit in the door of her house, and she's marshaled all against this man and for you. Now write her something of gratitude and common sense, and swear to me as well that you'll remain indoors."
I got up and went to the master's writing desk. I picked up the pen. I was stopped by an awful clatter, and then a series of piercing, irritating cries. They echoed through the stone rooms of the house. I heard people running. Ricardo leapt to attention and put his hand on the hilt of his sword. I gathered up my own weapons, unsheathing my light rapier and my dagger both.
"Good Lord Jesus, the man can't be in the house!"
A horrid scream drowned out the others. The smallest of us all, Giuseppe, appeared in the door, his face a luminous white and his eyes big and round.
"What the hell's the matter?"
Ricardo demanded, catching hold of him.
"He's been stabbed. Look, he's bleeding," I said.
"Amadeo! Amadeo!"
It rang loudly from the stone stairwell. It was the Englishman's voice. The boy doubled over in his pain. The wound was in the pit of his stomach, utterly cruel. Ricardo was beside himself.
"Shut the doors," he shouted.
"How can I," I cried, "when the other boys may blunder right into his path?" I ran out and into the big salon, and into the portego, the great room of the house. Another boy, Jacope, lay crumpled on the floor, pushing at it with his knees. I saw the blood running on the stones.
"Oh, this is beyond all fairness. This is a slaughter of innocents," I shouted. "Lord Harleck, show yourself! You're about to die!"
I heard Ricardo cry out behind me. The little boy was obviously dead. I ran towards the stairs.
"Lord Harleck, I'm here!" I called out. "Come out, you brutish coward, you slayer of children! I have a millstone ready for your neck!"
Ricardo spun me around.
"There, Amadeo," he whispered. "I'm with you."
His blade sang out as he drew it. He was much better than me with the sword, but this battle was mine. The man was at the far end of the portego. I had hoped he would be staggering drunk, but no such luck. I saw in a moment that any dream he might have had of taking me away by force was now gone. He had slain two boys, and he knew his lust had led him to a final stand. This was hardly an enemy crippled by love.
"Jesus in heaven, help us," whispered Ricardo.
"Lord Harleck," I cried, "you dare make a shambles of my master's house?"
I stepped aside from Ricardo to give us both room, as I motioned Ricardo to come forward, away from the head of the steps. I felt the weight of the rapier, not heavy enough. I wished to God I had practiced with it more. The Englishman came towards me, a taller man than I had ever noted, with a great reach to his arm that would be a powerful advantage, his cape flapping, his feet sheathed in heavy boots, his rapier raised, and his long Italian dagger ready in the other hand. At least he didn't have a true and heavy sword. Dwarfed by the great room, he was nevertheless big of stature, and had a head of roaring British copper hair. His blue eyes were stewed in blood, but he was steady in his walk and in his murderous gaze. His face was wet with bitter tears.
"Amadeo," he called out over the vast room as he came on, "you cut my heart out of my chest while I lived and breathed, and you took it with you. We shall be together this night in hell."
Chapter 6. The high long portego of our house, the entrance hall, was a perfectly wonderful place to die. There was nothing in it to mar its gorgeous mosaic floors with their circles of colored stones and their festive pattern of winding flowers and tiny wild birds. We had the entire field upon which to fight, with not a chair in the way to stop us from killing each other. I advanced on the Englishman before I had time to really admit that I wasn't very good with the sword yet, had never shown an instinct for it, and I had no inkling of just what my master would have me do just now, that is, what he would advise if he were here. I made several bold thrusts at Lord Harlech, which he parried so easily that I should have lost heart. But just when I thought I'd catch my breath and maybe even run, he swept in with his dagger and slashed my left arm. The cut stung me and infuriated me. I went after him again, this time managing, with considerable luck, to get him across the throat. It was just a scratch, but it bled furiously down his tunic, and he was as angry as I was to be cut.
"You horrid, damnable little devil," he said. "You made me adore you so you could draw and quarter me at your pleasure. You promised me you'd come back."
In fact, he kept up this sort of verbal barrage the entire time we fought. He seemed to need it, rather like a goading battle drum and fife.
"Come on, you despicable little angel, I'll tear your wings off," he said.
He drove me back with a fast volley of thrusts. I stumbled, lost my balance, and fell, but managed to scramble up again, using the low position to stab dangerously close to his scrotum as I did so, which gave him a start. I ran at him, knowing now there was nothing to be gained by drawing this out. He dodged my blade, laughed at me, and caught me with the dagger, this time on the face.
"Pig!"
I growled before I could stop myself. I hadn't known I was so completely vain. My face, no less. He'd cut it. My face. I felt the blood gushing as it does from face wounds, and I rushed at him again, this time forgetting all the rules of the encounter and thrashing the air with my sword in a fierce, crazy series of circles. Then, as he parried frantically left and right, I ducked and caught him with the dagger in the belly and ripped upward, stopped by the thick, golden-crusted leather of his belt. I backed up as he sought to slaughter me with both his weapons, and then he dropped them and grabbed, as men do, for the belching wound. He fell down on his knees.
"Finish him!"
shouted Ricardo. He stood back, a man of honor already.
"Finish him now, Amadeo, or I do it. Think what he's done under this roof!"
I lifted my sword. The man suddenly grabbed up his own with his bloody hand and flashed it at me, even as he groaned and winced with his pain. He rose up and ran at me in one gesture. I jumped back. He fell to his knees. He was sick and shivering. He dropped the sword, feeling again for his wounded belly. He didn't die, but he couldn't fight on.
"Oh, God," said Ricardo.
He clutched his dagger, but he obviously couldn't bring himself to hack away at the unarmed man. The Englishman went over on his side. He drew his knees up. He grimaced and he laid his head down on the stone, his face formal as he took a deep breath. He fought terrible pain and the certainty that he would die. Ricardo stepped forward and laid the tip of his sword on Lord Harlech's cheek.
"He's dying. Let him die," I said. But the man continued to breathe.
I wanted to kill him. I really wanted to. But it was impossible to kill someone who lay there, so placid and so brave. His eyes took on a wise, poetical expression.
"And so it ends here,"
he said in a small voice that perhaps Ricardo didn't even hear.
"Yes, it ends," I said. "End it nobly." "Amadeo, he slew the two children," said Ricardo. "Pick up your dagger, Lord Harlech," I said. I kicked the weapon at him. I pushed it right at his hand. "Pick it up, Lord Harlech," I said. The blood was running down my face and down my neck, tickling and sticky. I couldn't stand it. I wanted more to wipe my own wounds than to bother with him. He turned over on his back. The blood came out of his mouth and out of his gut. His face was wet and shiny, and his breathing became very labored. He seemed young again, young as he had when he threatened me, an overgrown boy with a big mop of flaming curls.
"Think about me when you begin to sweat, Amadeo," he said, his voice still small and now hoarse. "Think about me when you realize that your life, too, is finished."
"Run him through," said Ricardo in a whisper. "He could take 2 days to die with that wound."
"And you won't have 2 days," said Lord Harlech from the floor, panting. "With the poisoned cuts I gave you. Feel it in your eyes. Your eyes burn, don't they, Amadeo? The poison goes into the blood, and it strikes the eyes first. Are you dizzy?"
"You bastard," said Ricardo. He stabbed the man with his rapier right through his tunic, once, twice, then 3 times. Lord Harlech grimaced. His eyes fluttered, and out of his mouth came a final gout of blood. He was dead.
"Poison?" I whispered. "Poison on the blade?"
Instinctively, I felt my arm where he had cut me. My face, however, bore the deeper wound.
"Don't touch his sword or dagger. Poison." "He was lying. Come, let me wash you," said Ricardo. "There's no time to waste."
He tried to pull me from the room.
"What are we going to do with him, Ricardo? What can we do? We're here alone without the master. There are 3 dead in this house, maybe more."
As I spoke, I heard steps at both ends of the great room. The little boys were coming out of their hiding places, and I saw one of the teachers with them, who had apparently been keeping them out of the way. I had mixed feelings on this score, but these were all children, and the teacher an unarmed man, a helpless scholar. The older boys had all gone out, as was the custom in the morning, or so I thought.
"Come on, we have to get them all to a decent place," I said. "Don't touch the weapons."
I signaled for the little ones to come.
"We'll carry him to the best bedchamber, come on, and the boys as well."
As the little ones struggled to obey, some of them began to cry.
"You, give us a hand," I said to the teacher. "Watch out for the poisoned weapons."
He stared at me wildly.
"I mean it, it's poison." "Amadeo, you're bleeding all over," he cried shrilly in a panic. "What poisoned weapons? Dear God, save us all."
"Oh, stop it," I said. But I could stand this situation no longer, and as Ricardo took charge of the moving of the bodies, I rushed into my master's bedroom to attend to my wounds. I dumped the whole pitcherful of water into the basin in my haste, and grabbed up a napkin with which to catch the blood that was flowing down my neck and into my shirt. "Sticky, sticky mess," I cursed. My head swam, and I almost fell. Grabbing the edge of the table, I told myself not to be Lord Harlech's fool. Ricardo had been right. Lord Harlech had made up that lie about the poison. Poison the blade, indeed. But as I told myself this story, I looked down and saw for the first time a scratch, apparently made by his rapier on the back of my right hand. My hand was swelling, as if this were an insect's venomous work. I felt my arm and my face. The wounds there were swelling, great welts forming behind the cuts. Again there came the dizziness. The sweat dripped off me right into the basin, which was now full of red water that looked like wine.
"Oh, my God, the devil's done this to me!" I said.
I turned and the entire room began to tilt, and then to float. I rocked on my feet. Someone caught me. I didn't even see who it was. I tried to say Ricardo's name, but my tongue was thick in my mouth. Sounds and colors mingled in a hot, pulsing blur. Then, with astonishing clarity, I saw the embroidered baldachin of the master's bed over my head. Ricardo stood over me. He spoke to me rapidly and somewhat desperately, but I couldn't make out what he said. Indeed, it seemed he spoke a foreign tongue, a pretty one, very melodious and sweet, but I couldn't understand a word of it.
"I'm hot," I said. "I'm burning. I'm so hot that I can't bear it. I have to have water.
Put me in the master's bath. He didn't seem to have heard me at all. On and on he went with his obvious pleading. I felt his hand on my forehead, and it burned me, positively burned me. I begged him not to touch me, but this he didn't hear, and neither did I. I wasn't even speaking. I wanted to speak, but my tongue was too heavy and too big. You'll get the poison, I wanted to cry. I could not. I closed my eyes. Mercifully, I drifted. I saw a great sparkling sea, the waters off the island of the Lido, crenellated and beautiful beneath the noonday sun. I floated on this sea, perhaps in a small bark, or maybe just on my back. I couldn't feel the water itself, but there seemed nothing between me and its gentle tossing waves that were big and slow and easy and carried me up and then down. Far off, a great city gleamed on the shore. At first I thought it was Torcello, or even Venice, and that I had been turned around somehow and was floating towards the land. Then I saw it was much bigger than Venice, with great, piercing, reflective towers, as if it had been made entirely of brilliant glass. Oh, it was so lovely. "Am I going there?" I asked. The waves seemed then to fold over me, not with a suffocating wetness, but merely a quiet blanket of heavy light. I opened my eyes. I saw the red of the taffeta baldachin above. I saw the golden fringe sewn on the velvet bed-curtains, and then I saw Bianca Soldarini there above me. She had a cloth in her hand. "There wasn't enough poison on those blades to kill you," she said. "It's merely made you sick. Now listen to me, Amadeo. You must take each breath with quiet force and resolve to fight this sickness and to get well. You must ask the very air itself to make you strong and be confident of it. That's it. You must breathe deeply and slowly, yes, exactly. And you must realize that this poison is being sweated out of you, and you must not believe in this poison, and you must not fear."
"The master will know," said Ricardo.
He looked drawn and miserable, and his lips quivered. His eyes were flooded with his tears. Oh, ominous sign, certainly.
"The master will know somehow. He knows all things. The master will break his journey and come home."
"Wash his face," said Bianca calmly. "Wash his face and be quiet."
How brave she was. I moved my tongue, but I couldn't form words. I wanted to say that they must tell me when the sun sank, for then and only then might the master come. There was surely a chance. Then and only then. He might appear. I turned my head to the side, away from them. The cloth was burning me.
"Softly, quietly," said Bianca. "Take in the air, yes, and do not be afraid."
A long time passed as I lay there, hovering just below perfect consciousness, and thankful that their voices were not sharp, and their touch was not so terrible. But the sweating was awful, and I despaired utterly of being cool. I tossed and tried to get up once, only to feel terribly sick, sick unto vomiting. With a great relief I realized they had laid me back down.
"Hold on to my hands," said Bianca,
and I felt her fingers grasping mine, so small and too hot, hot like everything else, hot like hell, I thought. But I was too sick to think of hell, too sick to think of anything but vomiting up my insides into a basin and getting to somewhere cool. Oh, just open some windows, open them on the winter. I don't care, open them. It seemed quite a nuisance that I might die, and nothing more. Feeling better was of far greater importance, and nothing troubled me as to my soul or any world to come. Then, abruptly, all things changed. I felt myself rise upwards, as if someone had yanked me by my head out of the bed and sought to pull me up through the red cloth baldachin and through the ceiling of the room. Indeed, I looked down, and to my utter amazement, I saw myself lying on the bed. I saw myself as if there were no baldachin above my body to block the view. I looked far more beautiful than I ever imagined myself to be. Understand, it was utterly dispassionate. I did not feel an exultation in my own beauty. I only thought, what a beautiful young boy. How gifted he has been by God. Look at his long, delicate hands, how they lie beside him, and look at the deep russet of his hair. And that was me all the time, and I didn't know it, or think what effect it had on those who saw me as I moved through life. I didn't believe their blandishments. I had only scorn for their passion. Indeed, even the master had seemed before to be a weak and deluded being forever desiring me. but I understood now why people had somewhat taken leave of their senses. The boy there, dying on the bed, the boy who was the cause of weeping all around in this large chamber, the boy seemed the very embodiment of purity, and the very embodiment of youth on the verge of life. What did not make sense to me was the commotion in the room. Why did everyone weep? I saw a priest in the doorway, a priest I knew from the nearby church, and I could see that the boys argued with him and feared to let him near me as I lay on the bed, lest I be afraid. It all seemed a pointless imbroglio. Ricardo should not wring his hands. Bianca should not work so hard, with her damp cloth and her soft, but obviously desperate words. Oh, poor child, I thought. You might have had a little more compassion for everyone if you had known how beautiful you were, and you might have thought yourself a little bit stronger and more able to gain something for yourself. As it was, you played sly games on those around you, because you did not have faith in your own self, or even know what you were. It seemed very clear, the error in all this, but I was leaving this place. The same draft that had pulled me up out of the pretty young body that lay on the bed was pulling me upwards into a tunnel of fierce, noisy wind. The wind swirled around me, enclosing me completely and tightly in this tunnel, yet I could see in it other beings who looked on even as they were caught in it and moved by the incessant fury of this wind. I saw eyes looking on me. I saw mouths open as if in distress. I was pulled higher and higher through this tunnel. I didn't feel fear, but I felt a fatality. I could not help myself. That was your error when you were that boy down there, I found myself thinking. But this is indeed hopeless. And just as I concluded, so I came to the end of this tunnel. It dissolved. I stood on the shore of that lovely, sparkling sea. I wasn't wet from the waves, but I knew them, and I said out loud, "Oh, I'm here. I've come to the shore. Look, there are the towers of glass." As I looked up, I saw that the city was far away, over a series of deep green hills, and that a path led to it, and that flowers bloomed richly and gorgeously on either side of the path. I had never seen such flowers, never seen such shapes and petal formations, and never, never beheld such colors in all my life. There were no names in the artistic canon for these colors. I couldn't call them by the few weak, inadequate labels which I knew. Oh, would the painters of Venice ever be astonished at these colors, I thought, and to think how they would transform our work, how they would set ablaze our paintings, if only they could be discovered in some source that might be ground into pigment and blended with our oils. But what a pointless thing to do. No more painting was needed. All the glory that could be accomplished by color was here in this world revealed. I saw it in the flowers. I saw it in the variegated grass. I saw it in the boundless sky that rose up and over me and behind the distant blinding city, and it too flashed and glowed with this great harmony of colors, blending and twinkling and shimmering, as if the towers of this city were made of a miraculous, thriving energy rather than a dead or earthly matter or mass. A great gratitude flowed out of me. My whole being gave itself up to this gratitude. "Lord, I see now," I said aloud. "I see and I understand." It did at that moment seem very clear to me, the implications of this varied and ever-increasing beauty, this pulsing, radiant world. It was so very pregnant with meaning that all things were answered, all things were utterly resolved. I whispered the word "yes" over and over. I nodded, I think, and then it seemed quite absurd to bother to say anything in words at all. A great force emanated from the beauty. It surrounded me as if it were air or breeze or water, but it was none of these. It was far more rarefied and pervasive, and though it held me with a formidable strength, it was nevertheless invisible and without pressure or palpable form. The force was love. Oh, yes, I thought, it is love, it is complete love, and in its completeness it makes all that I have ever known meaningful. For every disappointment, every hurt, every misstep, every embrace, every kiss was but a foreshadowing of this sublime acceptance and goodness. For the bad steps had told me what I lacked, and the good things, the embraces, had shown me a glimpse of what love could be. All my life this love made meaningful, sparing nothing, and as I marveled at this, accepting it completely and without urgency or questioning, a miraculous process began. all my life came to me in the form of all those I had ever known. I saw my life from the very first moments, and up until the moment that had brought me here. It was not a terribly remarkable life. It contained no great secret or twist or pregnant matter that changed my heart. On the contrary, it was but a natural and common string of myriad tiny events, and these events involved all the other souls whom I had ever touched. I saw now the hurts I'd inflicted, and the words of mine which had brought solace, and I saw the result of the most casual and unimportant things I had done. I saw the banquet hall of the Florentines, and again in the midst of them I saw the blundering loneliness with which they stumbled into death. I saw the isolation and the sadness of their souls as they had fought to stay alive. What I could not see was my master's face. I could not see who he was. I could not see into his soul. I could not see what my love meant to him, or what his love meant for me. But this was of no importance. In fact, I only realized it afterwards, when I tried to recount the entire event. What mattered now was only that I understood what it meant to cherish others, and to cherish life itself. I realized what it had meant when I painted pictures, not the ruby-red, bleeding, and vibrant pictures of Venice, but old pictures in the antique Byzantine style, which had once flowed so artlessly and perfectly from my brush. I knew then I had painted wondrous things, and I saw the effects of what I had painted, and it seemed then a great crowd of information inundated me. Indeed, there was such a wealth of it, and it was so easy to comprehend, that I felt a great, light joy. The knowledge was like the love, and like the beauty. Indeed, I realized with a great triumphant happiness that they were all, the knowledge, the love, and the beauty, they were all one. Oh, yes, how could one not see it? It's so simple, I thought. If I had had a body with eyes, I would have wept, but it would have been a sweet weeping. As it was, my soul was victorious over all small and enervating things. I stood still, and the knowledge, the facts, as it were, the hundreds upon hundreds of small details which were like transparent droplets of magical fluid passing through me and into me, filling me and vanishing to make way for more of this great shower of truth. All this seemed suddenly to fade. There beyond stood the glass city, and beyond it a blue sky, blue as a sky at midday, only one which was now filled with every known star. I started out for the city. Indeed, I started with such impetuosity and such conviction that it took three people to hold me back. I stopped. I was quite amazed, but I knew these men. These were priests, old priests of my homeland, who had died long before I had even come to my calling, all of which was quite clear to me, and I knew their names and how they had died. They were, in fact, the saints of my city, and of the great house of catacombs where I had lived. "Why do you hold me?" I asked. "Where's my father? He's here now, is he not?" No sooner had I asked this than I saw my father. He looked exactly as he had always looked. He was a big, shaggy man, dressed in leather for hunting, with a full grizzled beard and thick, long auburn hair, the same color as my own. His cheeks were rosy from the cold wind, and his lower lip, visible between his thick mustache and his gray-streaked beard, was moist and pink as I remembered. His eyes were the same bright china blue. He waved at me. He gave his usual, casual, hearty wave, and he smiled. He looked just like he was going off into the grasslands, in spite of everyone's advice and everyone's caution, to hunt, with no fear at all of the Mongols or the Tatars swooping down on him. After all, he had his great bow with him, the bow only he could string, as if he were a mythical hero of the great grassy fields, and he had his own sharpened arrows and his big broadsword with which he could hack off a man's head with one blow. "Father, why are they holding me?" I asked. He looked blank. His smile simply faded, and his face lost all expression, and then to my sadness, to my terrible, shocking sadness, he faded in his entirety, and he wasn't there. The priests beside me, the men with their long gray beards and their black robes, spoke to me in soft, sympathetic whispers, and they said, "André, it's not time for you to come." I was deeply distressed, deeply. Indeed, I was so sad that I could form no words of protest. Indeed, I understood that no protest I might make mattered, and then one of the priests took my hand. "No, this is always the way with you," he said. "Ask." He didn't move his lips when he spoke, but it wasn't necessary. I heard him very clearly, and I knew that he meant no personal malice to me. He was incapable of such a thing. "Why, then," I asked, "can't I stay? Why can't you let me stay when I want to, and when I've come this far?" "Think on all you've seen. You know the answer." And I had to admit that in an instant I did know the answer. It was complex and yet profoundly simple, and it had to do with all the knowledge I had gained. "You can't take this back with you," said the priest. "You'll forget all the particular things you learned here, but remember the overall lesson, that your love for others and their love for you, that the increase of love in life itself around you is what matters." It seemed a marvelous and comprehensive thing. It seemed no simple, small cliché. It seemed so immense, so subtle, yet so total, that all mortal difficulties would collapse in the face of its truth. I was at once returned to my body. I was at once the auburn-haired boy dying in the bed. I felt a tingling in my hands and feet. I twisted, and a wretched pain flamed down my back. I was all afire, sweating and writhing as before, only now my lips were badly cracked, and my tongue was cut and blistered against my teeth.
"Water," I said. "Please, water."
A soft sobbing came from those around me. It was mingled with laughter and expressions of awe. I was alive, and they had thought me dead. I opened my eyes, and I looked at Bianca.
"I won't die now," I said. "What is it, Amadeo?"
she asked. She bent down and put her ear to my lips.
"It isn't time," I said.
They brought me cool white wine. It was mixed with honey and lemon. I sat up and I drank gulp after gulp of it.
"It's not enough," I said softly, weakly,
but I was falling asleep. I went down into the pillows and I felt Bianca's cloth wipe my forehead and my eyes. What a sweet mercy it was, and how very grand to give that small comfort, which was all the world to me. All the world. All the world. I had forgotten what I had seen on the other side. My eyes snapped open. "Recover it," I thought desperately. But I remembered the priest, vividly as though I had just talked to him in another room. He had said I couldn't remember. And there was so much more to it, infinitely more, such things as only my master might understand. I closed my eyes. I slept. Dreams couldn't come to me. I was too ill, too feverish. But in my own way, stretched thin upon a consciousness of the moist hot bed and the sluggish air beneath the baldachin, upon the blurred words of the boys and Bianca's sweet insistence, I did sleep. The hours ticked. I knew them, and gradually some comfort came to me, and that I got used to the sweat that smothered my skin and the thirst that hurt my throat, and I lay without protest, drifting, waiting for my master to come. "I have so many things to tell you," I thought. "You will know about the Glass City. I must explain that I was once, but I couldn't quite remember. A painter, yes, but what sort of painter? And how? And my name? Andrei. When had I been so called?" Chapter 7. Slowly, over my consciousness of the sickbed and the humid room, there dropped the dark veil of heaven. Spread out in all directions were the sentinel stars, splendid as they shone above the glinting towers of the Glass City, and in this half-sleep, now aided by the most tranquil and blissful of illusions, the stars sang to me. Each from its fixed position in constellation and in void, gave forth a precious glimmering sound, as if great chords were struck inside each flaming orb, and by means of its brilliant gyrations broadcast through all the universal world. Such sounds I had never heard with my earthly ears, but no disclaimer can approximate this airy and translucent music, this harmony and symphony of celebration. O Lord, if thou wert music, this then would be thy voice, and no discord could ever prevail against thee. Thou wouldst cleanse the ordinary world of every troubling noise with this, the fullest expression of thy most intricate and wondrous design, and all triviality would fade away, overwhelmed by this resounding perfection. This was my prayer, my heartfelt prayer, coming in an ancient tongue, most intimate and effortless, as I lay slumbering. Stay with me, beauteous stars, I begged, and let me never seek to fathom this fusion of light and sound, but only give myself to it utterly and unquestionably. The stars grew large and infinite in their cold, majestic light, and slowly all the night was gone, and there remained one great, glorious, and sourceless illumination. I smiled. I felt my smile with blind fingers on my lips, and as the light grew brighter still and ever closer, as though it were an ocean of itself, I felt a great saving coolness over all my limbs.
"Don't fade, don't go away, don't leave me." My own whisper was a woeful small thing. I pressed my throbbing head into the pillow. But it had spent its time, this grand and overriding light, and now must fade and let the common blink of candles move against my half-closed eyes, and I must see the burnished gloom around my bed, and simple things, such as a rosary laid across my right hand with ruby beads and golden cross, and there a prayer book open to my left, its pages gently folding in a small stir of breeze that moved as well the smooth taffeta in ripples overhead in its wooden frame. How lovely it all did seem, these plain and ordinary things that made up this silent and elastic moment. Where had they gone? My lovely swan-necked nurse and my weeping comrades. Had night worn them down to where they slept, so that I might cherish these quiet moments of unobserved wakefulness? My mind was gently crowded with a thousand lively recollections. I opened my eyes. All were gone, save one who sat beside me on the bed, looking down at me with eyes both dreamy and remote, and coldly blue, far paler than a summer sky, and filled with a near-faceted light, as they fixed so idly and indifferently upon me. My master here, with hands folded in his lap, a seeming stranger, viewing all as if it could not touch his chiseled grandeur. The smileless expression set upon his face seemed made there forever.
"Merciless," I whispered.
"No, oh no," he said. His lips did not move. "But tell me once again the whole tale. Describe this glassy city."
"Ah, yes, we've talked of it, have we not? Of those priests who said I must come back, and those old paintings, so antique, which I thought so very beautiful. Not made by human hands, you see, but by the power invested in me, which passed through me, and I had only to take up the brush, and there the Virgin and the saints were mine to discover."
"Don't cast those old forms away," he said, and once again his lips showed no sign of the voice I heard so distinctly, a voice that pierced my very ears, as any human voice might do, with his tone, his very timbre. "For forms change, and reason now is but tomorrow's superstition, and in that old restraint there lay a great sublime intent, an indefatigable purity. But tell me once again about the glassy city."
I sighed.
"You've seen the molten glass, as I have," I said, "when taken from the furnace, a glowing blob of horrifying heat upon a spear of iron, a thing that melts and drips so that the artist's wand may pull and stretch it, or fill it full of breath to form the perfect rounded vessel? Well, it was as if that glass came up out of the moist Mother Earth herself, a molten torrent spewing to the clouds. And out of these great liquid jets were born the crowded towers of the glassy city,
not imitating any form built by men, but perfect as the heated force of earth had naturally ordained, in colors unimaginable.
Who lived in such a place? How far away it seemed, yet utterly attainable. But one short walk over hills sweet with willowing green grass and leafy fluttering flowers of the same fantastical hues and tints, a quiet, thunderous, and impossible apparition.
I looked at him because I had been looking off and back into my vision.
"Tell me what these things mean," I asked. "Where is this place, and why was I allowed to see it?"
He gave a sad sigh and looked away himself, and now back at me, his face as aloof and unbending as before, only now I saw the thick blood in it, that once again, as it had been the night before, was pumped full of human heat from human veins, which had no doubt been his late repast this same evening.
"'Won't you even smile now as you say farewell?' I asked. "'If this bitter coldness now is all you feel, "'and you would let me die of this rampant fever? "'I'm sick unto death, you know it. "'You know the nausea that I feel. "'You know the hurt inside my head. "'You know the ache in all my joints, "'and how these cuts burn in my skin "'with their indisputable poison. "'Why are you so very far away?' Yet here, come home to sit beside me and feel nothing.
I feel the love I've always felt when I look at you, he said. My child, my son, my sweet enduring one, I feel it. It's walled up inside where it should stay, perhaps, and let you die, for yes, you will. And then perhaps your priests will take you, for how can they not when there is no returning?
Ah, but what if there are many lands? What if on the second fall I find myself on yet another shore, and sulphur rises from the boiling earth, and not the beauty first revealed to me? I hurt. These tears are scalding. So much is lost. I can't remember. It seems I say those same words so much. I can't remember.
I reached out. He didn't move. My hand grew heavy and dropped on the forgotten prayer book. I felt the stiff vellum pages beneath my fingers.
What's killed your love? Was it the things I did? That I brought the man here who slew my brothers? Or that I died and saw such wonders? Answer me.
I love you still. I will all my nights and all my slumbering days forever. Your face is as a jewel given me, which I can never forget, though I may foolishly lose it. Its glister will torture me forever. Amadeo, think on these things again. Open your mind as if it were a shell, and let me see the pearl of all they taught you.
Can you, Master? Can you understand how love and love alone could mean so very much, and all the world be made of it? The very blades of grass, the leaves of trees, the fingers of this hand that reaches for you? Love, Master, love! And who will believe such simple and immense things when there are dexterous and labyrinthian creeds and philosophies of man-made and ever-seductive complexity? Love. I heard the sound of it. I saw it. Were these the delusions of a feverish mind, a mind afraid of death?
Perhaps, he said, his face still feelingless and motionless. His eyes were narrow, prisoners of their own shrinking from what they saw. "'Ah, yes,' he said. "'You die, and I let you, and I think there might be for you but one shore. "'And there you'll find again your priests, your city.'
"'It's not my time,' I said. "'I know it. "'And such a statement cannot be undone by a mere handful of hours. "'Smash the ticking clock. "'They meant by a soul's incarnate life it wasn't time.' Some destiny carved in my infant hand will not be so soon fulfilled or easily defeated.
I can tip the odds, my child, he said. This time his lips moved. The pale sweet coral brightened in his face, and his eyes grew wide and unguarded, the old self I knew and cherished. I can so easily take the last strength left in you.
He leant over me. I saw the tiny variegations in the pupils of his eyes, the bright, deep-pointed stars behind the darkening irises. His lips, so wondrously decorated with all the tiny lines of human lips, were rosy as if a human kiss resided there.
I can so easily take one last fatal drink of your child's blood, one last quaff of all the freshness I so love, and in my arms I'll hold a corpse so rich in beauty that all who see it will weep. And that corpse will tell me nothing. You are gone, that much I'll know, and no more.
Do you say these things to torture me? Master, if I cannot go there, I want to be with you.
His lip worked in plain desperation. He seemed a man, and only that, the red blood of fatigue and sadness hovering on the borders of his eyes. His hand, out now to touch my hair, was trembling. I caught it as if it were the high, waving branch of a tree above me. I gathered his fingers to my lips, like so many leaves, and kissed them. Turning my head, I laid them on my wounded cheek. I felt the throb of the venomous cut beneath them, but more keenly still, I felt a strong tremor within them. I blinked my eyes.
"How many died tonight to feed you?" I whispered. "And how can this be, and love be the very thing the world is made of? You are too beautiful to be overlooked. I'm lost. I cannot understand it. But could I, if I were to live from this moment on, a simple mortal boy, could I forget it?"
"You cannot live, Amadeo," he said sadly. "You cannot live." His voice broke. "The poison's traveled in you too deep, too far and wide, and little drafts of my blood cannot overtake it."
His face was filled with anguish.
"Child, I can't save you. Close your eyes. Take my farewell kiss. There is no friendship between me and those on the far shore, but they must take what dies so naturally."
"Master, no! Master, I cannot try it alone! Master, they sent me back, and you are here, and were bound to be, and how could they not have known it?"
"Amadeo, they didn't care. The guardians of the dead are powerfully indifferent. They speak of love, but not of centuries of blundering ignorance. What stars are these that sing so beautifully when all the world is languishing in dissonance? I would you would force their hand, Amadeo."
His voice all but broke in his pain.
"Amadeo, what right have they to charge me with your fortune?"
I laughed a weak, sad little laugh. My fever shook me. A great wave of sickness overcame me. If I moved or spoke, I would suffer a dread, dry nausea that would shake me to no advantage. I'd rather die than feel this.
"Master, I knew you would give it some powerful analysis," I said. I tried not to make a bitter or sarcastic smile, but to seek the simple truth. My breath was now so hard for me, it seemed I could leave off breathing with no hardship at all. All Bianca's stern encouragements came back to me.
"Master," I said, "there is no horror in this world that is without final redemption."
"Yes, but for some," he pressed, "what is the price of such salvation? Amadeo, how dare they requisition me to their obscure designs? I pray they were illusions. Don't speak any more about their marvelous light. Don't think on it."
"No, sir? And for whose comfort do I sweep my mind so clean? Who is dying here?"
He shook his head.
"Go ahead, wring the blood tears from your eyes," I said. "And for what death do you hope yourself, sir? For you told me that it wasn't impossible for even you to die. Explain to me. That is, if there's time left before all the light I shall ever know winks out on me, and the earth devours the incarnate